Bienvenue à la balado-diffusion sur Radio Créon du colloque sur le rapport Taylor-Bouchard qui s'est tenu à Montréal en mai 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast on Radio Créon of the conference on the Bouchard-Taylor report that took place in Montreal in May 2009.
Le relais, Jean-Claude Tremblay approuve Richard qui cherche mot de l'œil. La passe est ici, il est seul. Il lance.
Vous allez voir ça, vous allez nous aimer.
Alors, oui, c'est Daniel Webster qui va donc nous présenter un commentaire, j'imagine, je présume en anglais, des deux présentations que vous venons d'entendre.
So I'm going to be a little bit Justin Trudeau-esque too and respond sort of going back and forth between English and French. These two very rich presentations, which I couldn't hope in 5 or 10 minutes to do justice to, but maybe just throw out a couple of questions that might help us move the discussion forward. So, Tariq, there's a point where you and I are in complete agreement, which is that I think it's a mistake that it's sometimes that liberals are sometimes guilty of themselves in their own self-understanding to think that neutrality isn't a conception, as it were, of the good society. Right? There's very much a vision of what society should be that is that underpins the neutralist project. And so I think that it's an important reminder that neutrality isn't just some kind of procedural constraint that is loose of any sort of vision of the... It sort of got dropped upon us from some proceduralist heaven, and we don't know why we have it and we don't know what it serves, but we know that we have to cleave to it. So I think that there is a conception of the good, as it were, that underpins the commitment to the right that neutrality is an expression of. Now... So I think to that degree, you and I are in complete agreement. Now, a question that I would simply ask about the first part of your presentation is that, I mean, I take it that your point was to say that there's a certain representation that the neutralist discourse in liberal theory sort of takes for granted, which is that religions are bodies of doctrine. They are potential justifications of different kinds of moral and political arrangements, which is itself non-neutral, right? That there's a certain type of religion which may actually be privileged by viewing it sort of in this very Protestant kind of way as something, to do with conscience and belief rather than with practice. And you say that this is very much a non-neutral conception of religion. So a question I'd have for you is what would neutrality that took into account the range of ways in which religion can manifest itself, both those that are more oriented around practice and those that are to some degree better accommodated by this vision of the sort of Protestant religion of belief and conscience. What would neutrality as between them require? Is it, trying to bring together the two parts of your presentation, the conclusion, is it the case that neutrality would simply sort of throw up its hands and say, let 1,000 flowers bloom and let's sort of adopt the additive strategy? The jump from the one to the other doesn't seem to me to be clear. I'll say something about your very interesting sort of sociological, and here I'm on extremely thin ice because not being a sociologist, that's never stopped any philosopher from doing armchair sociology, and it won't stop me. I mean, there's something, having lived for 4 years in England, something very recognizable in the picture that you paint those 5 points, the English or British attitude being that if we don't like an institution or if we don't like some kind of practice, rather than doing away with it, let's add another one on top of it and hope that we'll somehow neutralize the effects that we don't like about the first one. And it occurs to me that there's something very deep there, because the language sort of functions in the same way. If you think of the English language as evolution, the evolution of the English language, it's basically just this sort of messy bastard thing, which just sort of borrows from all other languages, and when it does borrow, doesn't feel the need to relegate the previous term to history. So we have 9 different ways of referring to the same thing. Whereas, you know, we have l'Académie Française in France that legislates, as it were, correct usage. Could you imagine such a thing in Britain? The Académie Anglaise, you know, saying, well. I mean, it boggles the imagination. Is it liberty or freedom that we should use? but, I mean, so to that degree, there's a certain way of approaching issues around religion that comes naturally in England, and that the additive approach that you described at the end may be a sort of natural consequence of. You know, we have now realized in Britain that, you know, the Protestant majority now has to... share space with Jews and Muslims and all these other people, rather than giving rise to a major sort of reconsideration of the whole model of the sort of cheek by jowl relationship of religion and the state. Let's just invite them in and in a fraternal kind of way, consider that the old relationship that we had between the state and religion, which is much more complicated than the modern model, just has to encompass these people in complicated ways, which we won't be able to formulate according to some clean, clear Cartesian principle. Now, I wonder whether, and I don't take this to be your implication at all, whether this model isn't just so peculiar and particular to the sort of worldview that seems to be the English or British, never get the difference quite clear, you know, whether it's so specific to this worldview that I've very quickly, that you quickly characterized, that its transportability to places like Quebec might just not exist. I mean, in Quebec, you know, the first time that I ever had to deal with issues like this had to do with religion in the schools. Religion in the schools, where I was part of a commission along with Micheline Milo, who's over here as well, where we had to consider how to deal with the fact that we had this old sort of compact between the Protestants and the Catholics that gave them sort of privileges within the school system. There were Catholic schools, Protestant schools, Catholic teaching, Protestant teaching, but no other religious teaching. How to adapt this in the context of you know, a society that had become quite different from the one that existed 200 years ago. And we did consider the additive option. And it seemed to me that really, I mean, there are practical considerations, right? You can't have, well, maybe you could. Maybe it was lack of imagination on our part that sort of prevented us from thinking that you might have a Jewish teacher and a Muslim teacher and a, you know, Hindu teacher and et cetera, giving classes in elementary schools at the same time. But it struck me that really nobody liked it. The Catholics didn't like it because, as opposed to the attitude that of the Church of England, the Catholics seemed the message that came across from the Catholics was, well, if you introduce all these other religions, the message that you send to children is one of relativism, right? You know, the fact that we have Catholic education is not just an identity thing; it's also to do with the fact that we think that this is the one true religion, and that if you have all these religious teachings being presented alongside one another, you are in effect cutting sort of the you know, couper l'herbe sous le, you know, under the feet of the religious argument, which is that this is basically true. And then you had people who were non-Catholics, who were secular, who didn't like it for the following reason. They thought, you know, we've waged this huge war, you know, sort of, not war, but we've waged this huge struggle in Quebec to get rid of the authority of the church, right? And this came very strongly out of women's groups, you know, and to find what? To find that under the new banner of some kind of multiculturalist tolerance or what have you, not only are we going to get the church back in, but we're going to get all these other benighted folks into our schools as well. And so it didn't seem that above and beyond pragmatic considerations, there was much of a constituency, even for the sort of philosophical idea of additive. Because the relationship between, whether it be from the Catholic side or from the sort of militant secular side, was very much one of a kind of suspicion, mutual suspicion and even hostility, born of a history that one just can't erase. It's a very simplistic view of Quebec history to say that you know, the church was entirely a bad thing in this province. There's a narrative according to which the church and the English basically kept, you know, the French Canadians down on the farm, as it were, and kept them out of political and economic authority. It's, you know, complicated, much more complicated history than that. But nonetheless, it is one of those myths, to come back of one of the themes that we had this morning, that is extremely deeply ingrained in a wide range of sort of sectors of the population in Quebec, that makes it the case that additiveness might just not be an option for us. Je vais passer au français pour dire quelques mots sur la présentation d'Éléonore, qui m'a semblé extrêmement intéressante, et peut-être pour lui poser une sorte de défi. Une des prémices de son argument était que, malgré les apparences, nous sommes beaucoup plus proches, nous et nos cousins français, sur la question de la laïcité, de secularism, que nous le pensons. Et que, au fond, le fait que la commission Stasi, l'opinion dissidente de notre invité Jean Bobereau nonobstant, et la commission Taylor-Bouchard en soient arrivées des conclusions différentes sur la question du voile, est due à des différences sur la question de savoir qui peut prétendre avoir l'autorité d'interpréter de manière décisive une pratique religieuse. Donc le voile, est-ce nécessairement un symbole de soumission de la femme? En France, on semble répondre... qu'on peut avoir l'autorité interprétative pour dire que oui. Ici, on a été un peu plus hésitant, devant manifestement la diversité des opinions avérées par les jeunes musulmanes qui portent le voile, et aussi par des conceptions un peu différentes de l'autonomie, une conception peut-être un peu perfectionniste en France et une conception peut-être un peu plus procédurale ici, un peu plus modérée. Donc, au fond, sur la laïcité, on en est à peu près... philosophiquement, sur un terrain assez similaire. Alors, je voudrais introduire un autre débat que celui sur le voile pour voir si on peut imaginer qu'une réaction un peu similaire à celle qui a eu lieu ici au Canada puisse être envisagée en France. Comme tu le sais, en Ontario, nous avons eu, le débat sur les tribunaux charia. Et un rapport a été produit par une femme qui était, donc Marianne Boyd, comme tu le sais, qui, je le rappelle pour l'auditoire, qui était la procureure générale de l'Ontario, une femme dont les convictions féministes étaient assez bien établies dans la communauté, et qui a surpris un peu tout le monde en produisant un rapport où une partie de l'argument qu'elle a présenté était très 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 pragmatique. Elle disait, écoutez, quoi qu'on pense des tribunaux charia, on est devant un choix. Soit on dit que ça ne devrait pas exister ici, et on joue donc dans la stratégie de l'autruche qui consiste à dire qu'on la bannit en sachant très bien qu'on n'a pas le pouvoir politique pour faire de sorte que dans les faits, les tribunaux charia cessent d'avoir un impact sur la vie des femmes, ou bien on prend une attitude beaucoup plus pragmatique et on se dit, étant donné que les tribunaux charia vont continuer à exister, il vaut mieux pour le sort des femmes qui sont assujetties à leur autorité, à leur pouvoir, que nous établissions une sorte de régime qui leur donne une certaine souveraineté, tout en leur imposant des limitations qui sont celles des chartes et des tribunaux de la société plus large. Bon, évidemment, McGuinty a tracé une croix sur cela, mais disons, l'idée a été débattue et continue à être débattue. On n'a pas lapidé Marion Boyd sur la place publique. Enfin, si, jusqu'à un certain point, bon, peut-être. Je suis en train de faire le point contraire de celui que... mais est-ce qu'une position comme celle-là aurait été envisageable? Si, est-ce qu'un rapport aurait pu être produit sur la place publique qui fasse ce genre d'argument un peu pragmatique en France? Au fond, ce que j'essaie de me dire, c'est est-ce qu'il n'y a pas, par rapport au principe... une attitude au principe de la laïcité, une attitude quand même peut-être un peu plus catégorielle, catégorique en France, alors que le rapport Boyd en étant une manifestation, on est peut-être davantage prêt au Canada à mesurer les implications pratiques que peut avoir la mise en vigueur d'un principe.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for your comments and questions, and actually it's quite remarkable because Daniel hadn't seen anything in advance from me, so this is all kind of spontaneous. And you've asked some very good, penetrating questions off the cuff. I'm very impressed. How might I try and answer them? Well, first of all, as I noted here. Your first question is that, okay, some of the things that I was saying about the difficulties about neutrality being, as it were, the view that says the state has to be neutral is not a neutral view about the state nor about religion. Okay, there's something in that, but isn't there some kind of better way of formulating a neutralist position or something that might approximate to a neutralist position? Well, yeah, I don't know whether there is, because it's so kind of tempting to have a kind of meta level to say that, you know, all these other doctrines, truths, and positions, they're somehow on a first order level or on a lower order level, but the doctrine that I want the world to live by is at this higher level and is kind of, you know, not can't be critiqued by them, but rather governs them, disciplines them. It is very tempting, and I think we're all tempted by it in different ways. But it does seem to me, well, I certainly don't have a way of getting out of that. So, okay, if I say you can't make a move like that legitimately, what is it that one can do? Well, I'm attracted to the kind of view that, say, Joe Karens expresses when he says that we need to be even-handed sometimes, that sometimes what we mean by treating equally, you know, different groups of people, different kinds of claims that are not entirely commensurable for a number of reasons, is, well, how do we find ways of treating them that, you know, can be justified in the appropriate contexts as even-handed, if not strictly neutral or numerically equal? Because, of course, you know, you've got, for instance, to take one example, take actually a French example, the 1905 law acknowledged that all the you know, the churches, cathedrals, and everything of the Catholic Church were the property of the Catholic Church. Now you have, you know, a century later, Muslims saying, well, we too need a religious infrastructure, and the state says, yeah, but we don't have anything to do with that. Look how we've treated the Catholics. They have to raise all the money themselves and so on, which actually isn't right about certain things. There are some fiscal advantages, and Catholic instructors are paid in schools and so on. But certainly the state doesn't build churches. But some Muslim groups say, well, we actually need support here. For instance, land. Can a local authority give us the land to build a mosque or a cemetery or something which has a clear religious purpose? And I think even-handedness there would acknowledge that the Catholics in 1905 started not on a kind of, you know, year zero basis, but they already had all that infrastructure. Here's a new large population, religious population, that don't have anything like that. The state may need to create forms of support and resource them and so on. I'm not sure whether that can be formulated into a principle. I certainly can't do it. But you know, there are ideas about fairness, especially, as I say, contextualized ideas about fairness and so on, which make us see that certain ways of acting inconsistently are not unreasonable, but are actually treating people in some ways, not neutrally, but even-handedly, you know, fairly under the circumstances. And, of course, I, you know, add to that, or say underline that, is the idea of always thinking how we can add people in, or to use another kind of metaphor, how we can, as it were, equalize upwards rather than equalize downwards. Because often that's one reaction that people have. So that in Britain we have, you know, the state out of public purse supports a very large number, you know, running into nearly 10,000 or so, something like a quarter, perhaps even a third, of school children in England are taught in schools run by churches. And so the new established religions, the newly settled religions, say, well, actually, we want that kind of resource extended to us. And some people who perhaps weren't happy with it in the first place think, hey, this is a great opportunity to get rid of the whole lot, and say, yes, Muslims are quite right. They are being treated very unjustly. Christians are privileged. Let us nationalize all schools, take away the schools from the churches. Muslims don't have a grievance then because they're being treated very fairly. But I don't know a single Muslim that's accepted that as a reasonable solution, because they see that dispossessing someone else is not a way of giving anything to Muslims. It's not a way of proper equalizing. It's, you know, equalizing downwards. Your next point about, given the kind of description that I offered about England and Britain, and I liked your paraphrase of it and your, you know, take on it and what you added to it and so on, that, you know, we have extra layers. Some are sometimes functional, some are semi-functional, some are dignified, and some get reactivated as things shift, and some get faded so far into the distance that we can then forget about them and write them off and so on. All this messiness, does this mean that everything I was saying is peculiar to England? No, I don't think I would draw that conclusion. I wanted to set the context because you do have to see it in that kind of context. But I don't say that everything is so particularistic and peculiar and so on. In fact, I would say that actually, and it's only really, I'd say in the last few years, I thought more about this and looked into it and read and so on, that I see that many of the things that I thought might have been distinctive about Britain belong to a northwestern European way of doing things. That Belgium, Netherlands, Scandinavia, Germany, in different ways, I'm not saying they're all similar, and of course they don't all have an established church and so on, that there are certain key broad characteristics. I mean, one of them is the pragmatic spirit. So make compromises, even if it's not entirely clear that, you know, the compromise is a completely principled one. So, you know, how you've treated the Protestant churches and the Catholic Church may not be entirely comparable, but you find some way of keeping everybody on board, and perhaps every two generations or so you might need to rewrite some of this, you know, give a bit more to something or take something away and so on, just to reflect change in circumstances and so on. So there's that pragmatic spirit, which is underwritten by the idea that you're trying to accommodate organized religious people, not tell them to marginalize themselves in relation to politics and so on. But you are taking them out of the realm of political power. You're still resourcing them in various ways. You're giving them public roles. You're certainly giving them public status. And it, you know, costs money and everything. But you're taking them away from political decision-making. To use the phrase I used in my paper, you allow religion to speak to power, but you don't allow it to hold power or to, you know, make decisions and so on. So that's another principle. And I think a third principle I'd put in is what I was referring to when I was saying some kind of recognition that religion is the public good, connected with the idea that there should be some degree of harmony and fraternalism between different religious groups, that you create a culture, an ethos, in which religious people, and in particular, you know, religious leaders and so on, bishops and people like that, don't only think about their church and its followers as this is the full map of all our concerns. They become, in some ways, stakeholders in the polity as a whole. So the Church of England speaks for the poor in the inner city. They don't say, oh, our members, you know, we did a survey and our members said this. They're not just like a trade union. They're more like, as if you like, the Labour Party, a socialist party, speaking about what they think is just and the common good, rather than just a trade union that says, yeah, we know this is going to cost more and so on, but our members are entitled to this, and you know, so on. So there is an ethos amongst churches and religious leaders that they speak to and address issues beyond their membership and so on. So I think there are a number of common things. England is by no means unique. And the last point I'll just deal with is the issue about, well, isn't there a problem here that we may satisfy nobody? Because obviously the secularists think, my goodness, before we had just, you know, one or two churches to deal with, now we've got all these people, all these beardy weirdies coming in and making various pronouncements and demanding this, that, and the other. And on the other hand, you know, isn't there a danger of relativizing something about religion that actually sincere religious people believe is beyond relativism? Well, I think my response to that would be that the alternatives also involve some kind of devaluation of religion in the eyes of religious people, or some religious people, you know, in particular the kind of the non-Protestant variety. And certainly, if we're talking about the Muslim case, which obviously dominates so much of our contemporary discussion, Muslims certainly feel that a religion that is privatized is an inferior religion, you know, because the public space is important. And everybody thinks this, or just about everybody thinks this, don't they? Humanists believe that there's something important about the public space. It is the space where certain things can be achieved which cannot be achieved in private, even in private associations, but certainly as kind of private individuals. We heard earlier this morning a conception of democratic citizenship and so on, which emphasizes the importance of public identities, new public identities, collectively made, collectively shaped, collectively remade and so on. Well, yeah, a lot of religious people think like that as well. So just to say to them, well, no, your identities have to be private, and it's the secular identities that only the secular identities that are to be exclusively public, I think is an alternative form of devaluation which seems to be perceived more as a hurt at the moment than the danger of relativism. So I don't hear many people complaining about relativism at the moment, but I can see that some people might interpret what I was talking about, religious fraternalism, as saying, well, you're saying no religion's true, really. All you guys, can you just work together so that we don't have a civil war? And, you know, I can see that some people might see that, but I don't see that as the present danger.
Oui, mais évidemment, oui, le rapport Boyd est un cas extrêmement intéressant. Alors, deux choses là-dessus. Il n'y a pas que... Dans le rapport Boyd, selon moi, même si tu as tout à fait raison d'insister sur le fait qu'elle avait un raisonnement pragmatique et de dire, bon, mais si on l'interdit, ça se passera quand même, mais là, il n'y aura plus de recours, qui d'ailleurs, à mon avis, est un genre de raisonnement qui soutient, enfin, où justement, on se place du côté des gens vulnérables qu'on prétend protéger de manière, on se met vraiment à leur place. Pas de façon paternaliste. Ceci étant, selon moi, dans le rapport Boyd, il y a aussi sous-jacente une vision de l'autonomie des femmes et une vision de l'autonomie en général, parce que elle avait tout un discours sur le fait qu'on ne pouvait pas se permettre de dire que sous prétexte qu'il s'agit de femmes immigrées et musulmanes, elle n'aurait aucune autonomie, aucune capacité de choix et pas la capacité de consentir à rentrer dans des procédures d'arbitrage familial. Donc ça va main dans la main, à mon avis, les deux choses. Donc ça, c'est par rapport au rapport Boyd. Par rapport à la France, est-ce qu'on aurait pu avoir des arguments pragmatiques de cette sorte en France ? Bien sûr, on en a eu. Sur la loi sur le foulard, mais bien sûr, même le Conseil d'État, dans ses premiers avis, a toujours eu une analyse relativement pragmatique, mettant l'accent en 89 déjà sur le fait qu'on n'allait quand même pas déscolariser des jeunes filles au prétexte de les émanciper. C'était quand même un peu paradoxal de les sortir de l'école publique. Bon, donc il y avait quand même une analyse pragmatique derrière, mais finalement, la question que tu poses pointe un changement en France sur la conception de la laïcité. Changement dont on aura sûrement l'occasion de parler, qui, alors, est-ce qu'on peut le dater de 89, est-ce qu'il faut le dater d'un peu d'avant ou quoi, mais qui, certainement, dans les années 90, on a vu, et qui, à mon avis, est en partie dû au fait que le problème social majeur, le problème de... la cohésion sociale, de l'intégration, donc du nation building, a changé. Quand dans les années 70-80, c'était un problème d'immigrés. Donc on parlait d'intégration. Dans les années 90, on arrive à la seconde génération qui donc sont des citoyens. Ce n'est pas des immigrés. On ne peut pas traiter ça avec des politiques d'intégration. Et il me semble que la laïcité a représenté l'espace symbolique, médiatique, discursif, tout ce qu'on veut, où on a pu reposer les mêmes questions, apporter les mêmes réponses assimilatrices, mais sur un autre, enfin, en changeant juste le, en changeant le terrain, parce que ben on parlait plus des mêmes, on pouvait plus parler d'accès à la citoyenneté, on pouvait plus parler d'assimilation culturelle puisque c'était des Français. Donc la laïcité a joué probablement a été drapée dans cette, enfin s'est retrouvée finalement le véhicule, le signifiant pour remettre encore une fois sur la table ce débat et encore une fois apporter une solution d'une tendance assimilatrice qui révèle des anxiétés identitaires certainement, de la xénophobie et bien d'autres choses encore.
Thank you very much.